And she said, don't be like that. And I said, and she said, but you know what, we'll invite you back sometime. And I said, right. I said, Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn is about to be court-martialed. She served more than a year in the brig at Fort Leonard Wood. And she said, are you saying we put her in jail? I said, of course not, but I'm saying that she can't come back. And you know you're not going to have this again. And I said, can I speak to the executive producer? She said, he's a very busy man. Anyway, people kept calling. I said, don't call us, call them. And after a day or two, I later met a woman in the elevator about a year later who said, oh my God, this shut down the Sally Jesse Raphael studios for 2 days, the numbers of calls that came in. And then they called and they said, the executive producer would like to talk to you. And I said, I'm a very busy person, I'm sorry. But they asked if I would cry censorship if they edited the program. And I said, no, I'm an editor too. They have that right. I assume they'd edit out Sally's fit. And and so the show did air. And but it aired with the headlines around the country that said things like, things get messy with Sally Jesse. And the response that was most interesting was from women on Southern military bases who called in and said, thank you. We share your view. And I think that is so important, and how rarely they see and hear an anti-war point of view fleshed out. What is that view? As they said, we can't have these debates on military bases. They are there to carry out orders. They are there to send their sons or daughters, or they themselves are going, or their husbands or their fathers, and they rely on civil society to have these debates about the most important issues of our day, about war and peace, about who's going to live and who's going to die. They rely on us to have a full discussion and make a civilized life and death decision about whether they will be sent overseas to kill or be killed. And we know how many Persian Gulf vets came back utterly traumatized. I was just thinking of Phil Berrigan's comments. He served in World War II, and he said, I learned to be an accomplished killer. And what this does to a person, and you think of all the vets who came back sick, of course, but more than a quarter of veterans. So if anyone says the U.S. government values our veterans, think of how many years they have fought for benefits to treat them, for some kind of recognition of what they have gone through. But here they were, and I think the lesson is that we can't automatically assume who's with you and who is not. I think all lines are being broken down now. The whole conservative, liberal dichotomy, it's all breaking down. And that's the lesson that I learned from the Sally Jesse Raphael show. And the other lesson was media activism. It's the listeners who called in, who made that show broadcast, who made sure that other voices were heard. And that makes a tremendous difference. It's why it's important you call into commercial talk shows. It's why it's important that people not only protest at the Pentagon and be heard, but also at the media houses, at the institutions. They are the most powerful institutions, corporations in the world today. One, because they're among the wealthiest, Disney and General Electric owning NBC, now it's Viacom that owns CBS, and AOL, Time Warner, Microsoft, NBC, all of these, MSNBC. They're not only powerful because they have money, but because they are the way most people learn about the rest of the world, through that corporate lens. And it's also, most importantly, the way the rest of the world sees us. Think about that. The great Indian writer Arundhati Roy came to the United States. She gave an incredible speech in Santa Fe, New Mexico, come September, it was called. And at the end of the speech, she thanked people for not throwing tomatoes at her. She said, I watch in India Fox News, and I was afraid to come here, what might happen. Well, think about what's happening to South Asians today. I mean, we can't keep up a democracy now. We can't do accurate reporting when it comes to, for example, the Pakistani community. We can't keep up. The number of South Asians who are being picked up on a daily basis now, in Brooklyn alone, it's 2 to 3 Pakistani men are being picked up a day. And they're being held in these detention centers, either Wackenhut or CCA, Corrections Corporation of America. They're being held in these detention facilities. They are shackled. And then they're shipped out. We were covering the third secret deportation, mass deportation of Pakistanis. There were 87 of them recently, 2 weeks ago. We went to look at the articles. We'd heard the story of one man who was taken off the plane. An incredible story, but he's just one person. What happened to him? His wife is American. He has 3 children. And one day they came to his house. It was the beginning of November. They busted into the house. His wife was in the shower with her daughter, who was three or four. And the little girl heard knocking on the door, and she ran out from the bathroom. And her mother said, don't open it. But she actually opened the door. Her father was sleeping, and her brother was on the couch. And the minute the door was open, the police, the FBI, they stormed in. They threw the boy, he was 9, into another room. The mother called for her daughter to bring her her clothes. She had nothing in the shower. And the FBI and police threw the girl in the room and said no. So the mother put on her husband's pants that were hanging in the bathroom. And she came out with a towel over her top in front of all these men. She said, what are you doing? Do you have a search warrant? And they said she was not to address them at all. This is America. She's an American citizen, and he's a Pakistani man married to an American citizen. He's been here for years. She said, what are you doing? Why are you taking him? One of the FBI or police got a little nervous, and they picked up the phone, and she heard them say, are you sure we have the right man here? This is a family. We just raided their home. And they went forward, and they dragged him out, and she didn't know what was happening, and she had to figure out what to do. She'd never had a lawyer before. She called the Coney Island Avenue Immigrants' Rights Project. And they raced to find out where he was been taking. She couldn't find out. Finally, it ended up he was put in the detention center in New Jersey. They were working around the clock. No one could find his documents. The federal government denied that they had him, even though they had a lawyer. Finally, the lawyer was able to locate him, and before you knew it, he was on the phone with his wife, and he said to her, they just said, put on civilian clothes. I think I'm being deported. And the lawyer raced out to the detention facility, and his wife raced after. She said, don't come with me. It was 3 in the morning. It was pouring rain. She said, I am going to see my husband before he is deported. And they went there. And the lawyer was saying, he is not to be taken out of this country. He is married to an American citizen. This is a terrible mistake. And she said, even though she was an immigration lawyer, she couldn't believe as this bus pulled up at 3 in the morning, why does this have to be done under cover of night except that there's something wrong? And all these men who are not criminals were being dragged out in shackles. And we interviewed a man on Election Day who was a human rights lawyer from Pakistan who had stood up against Musharraf. Why are all these Pakistani men, often against Musharraf, right, the dictator, being sent back to that country? Is it because they can talk about what's going on with the U.S. ally? Why Pakistan? And so they followed this bus, and the authorities said, if you follow this bus, we will arrest you. And they put him on the plane. The lawyer raced as the wife ran home and started to call Hillary Clinton, who wouldn't respond, and Charles Schumer, who wouldn't respond, desperately trying to get someone. The lawyer got a federal immigration judge and went into court and said, you've got to stop this deportation. Think about all the men who didn't have any representation, but he had a lawyer. And the judge looked and said, I stop it. And she said, well, how are we going to fax these papers, the lawyer said. He's on a plane. And she had gotten the number of one friendly prison guard, his cell phone. And the lawyer called that guard, and the judge said, give me the phone. And she got on the phone to the guy on the plane, the guard, and said, release that man, as it was headed down the runway. And they stopped, and he got off that plane. And we will wait to see now what happens with him. The decision is going to be made any day now. But that was because he had representation. And you know that most immigrants in this country who are going through this process, they don't have the right to representation. And this is happening in our country. There are so many things right now under the new legislation that's passed. If I see one more time that picture behind Bush protecting the homeland, as he signs the Homeland Security Act, what's in these acts? You know that really, forget everything else, but it is just a corporate welfare bill disguised as somehow protecting national security, giving corporations like this one, no one even knows who wrote this special provision of the bill that says that Eli Lilly will be exempt from any loss. Why Eli Lilly? Written into the Homeland Security bill. Could it have anything to do with the fact that on the chair, one of the heads of the Homeland Security Commission is a former head of the board of Eli Lilly, and the budget director of the Bush administration is the former head of North American Operations of Eli Lilly. No Congress member will claim credit for inserting this bill that says Eli Lilly is exempt from any and protected from any lawsuits. Eli Lilly, what does that have to do with national security? And now all of these parents didn't know they had anything to do with Al-Qaeda or anything else, who have been suing over the years the federal government for a product Eli Lilly had in vaccines called thimerosal, because they had mercury in it. Have had all, in the last few weeks, Ashcroft had all of the documents sealed that they could get access to for these lawsuits, and their cases have been thrown into, quote, vaccine courts, and they can't get access to any of the documents. They've been suing for years. What does this have to do with national security? It simply protects a major contributor to the Republican Party. And it's a series of these special provisions, and it's called national security. And then, of course, you have the USA Patriot Act, which, what, among other things, has Section 215, which puts librarians on the front line of the protection of our liberties. It says that FBI agents can go into libraries or into bookstores and can, with a warrant, demand of, and so often they go in without a warrant and people just get scared, demand of the librarian, has anyone come in here with an accent? What do they read? Can you show me the log, the internet log? Who used it? What were they looking at? And think, of course, as usual, who gets hit? It's people who have less means, more often than not people of color, who go to the public library to use the internet, who don't have access to computers at home. And these are what are being most surveilled, although we all are, make no mistake about it, through email and cameras and public spaces. And Section 215 says that the FBI can go in and ask anything they want about people, what they're reading, ask for logs. And the American Library Association is deeply concerned about this, has come out against this, and it threatens librarians. It says that they not only have to turn over this information, but that they cannot tell anyone about it, or they face prosecution, criminal prosecution themselves. Cannot even tell another librarian that who the man was who just came in, unless that other person has the information that they need to give over to the FBI. And so people are increasingly isolated and afraid, and it's why we all have to stand up and speak out. You don't have to agree with everything your neighbor says, but it's standing up for their right to say it. And especially in these times when you come out to forums like these, when you go to meetings, you're making it's safer for other people to do the same. There is safety in numbers. It makes a huge difference. It makes it safer for someone to express their point of view when they go to the water cooler at work, because we hear dissent And that's why media, public media, is so important, that we get used to hearing other views and that someone isn't singled out like the 60-year-old man who went to Gold's Gym in San Francisco and is as he's on the running machine on the treadmill, he is saying he's against the war. By the time he gets home, there's two FBI agents at his door saying, where did you get that information, or would you care to express your views any further? These are serious times, and we, whatever you feel, whether you're for war or against war, I think that there are basic principles we have to protect in this country, and they don't have to do with what is being allowed now by the USA Patriot Act like. The fact that someone can be detained and tried on a military barge, a U.S. military barge off of another country, in secret military courts, we won't know their name. We don't know what the secret charges are against them. We never get to see the secret evidence. They can be found guilty, and they can be sentenced to death by a military tribunal whose names we don't know, and they can be thrown overboard. This in the USA Patriot Act. I don't think even those that believe in war right now, that's what they're fighting for. And we have to be very clear about what's being passed in our name, the legislation, and the tremendous powers that are being given to the executive branch, to people like John Ashcroft. Just talked about Henry Kissinger's resignation. Bernard Law also resigned this morning, right? Cardinal Law. Who says grassroots action doesn't make a difference? You think he heard a higher voice telling him to leave? And maybe he did. He did. He was in Rome today. He was at the Vatican. But the strongest voice was the voice of the people, those who have been injured, those who've been sexually abused. It's quite incredible, and I don't know if it's my place to talk about the Catholic Church, not being Catholic myself, but to watch people excommunicated or lose their ability to be priests, even like Phil Berrigan, because he got married and had children. And they lose their position in the church, but you have these sex abusers, these people who prey on children, and they're protected by the church. And you think, who was showing the way to young people? People like Phil Berrigan, and you see who ascended in the church. So you have Bernard Law hearing the voice of the people, and in the end it was 58 parish priests and all of the people who brought lawsuits, who continually talked for years about what was going on, and yet he was protected by this incredible corporate veil of secrecy. We don't think of religions like this, but this is what had happened. So he's left, Law, Kissinger, and then there's Lott. Senator Lott, held a news conference today at 5:30. Well, 2 out of 3 is not bad. He did not resign. But you think about what Senator Lott said and what this country represents today. The question was, did he just misspeak? And he asked to be forgiven. He said he was not speaking from his heart, but from his head. What did he do last week, right? He hailed Strom Thurmond. How many other Republicans and Democrats have hailed Strom Thurmond, right? He is 100 years old, continues to be senator. And I have great respect for our elders. My grandmother is about to be 106. But you think about this man's record, Strom Thurmond, the man who ran in 1948 on the segregation forever platform. And you think about what Trent Lott said. Trent Lott, who didn't just say how he felt about him personally, and even that, to say the least, is highly offensive. But Trent Lott said, if we had elected this man 30 years ago, we wouldn't be in this mess we're in today. That's actually what he said 20 years ago. This time he said we wouldn't be in the situation we are today. He said, I want to say this about my state. When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems all of these years either. He said he misspoke. It reminded me of Dick Armey, the individual, not Congress. Dick Armey, who said one day, who was talking about Barney Frank, the gay Congress member from Massachusetts, and called him Barney Fag, and was recorded. He was talking to radio reporters, and was recorded, and he said he misspoke. He blamed the press for making a big deal of this. He hadn't had his coffee yet, he said. And I believed him. I believed him. He didn't have his wits about him, and he just called him what he always called him, instead of preparing for speaking to the press. And what these men say matters. When he called Barney Frank that, that was right in a period. It was right after the 94 Republican Revolution. I was in Washington covering Congress, the 104th Congress. It was a time of a series of brutal murders, gay murders, in Texas, in his district. And he would not support hate crimes legislation. Yes, what they say matters, and it sends a message around the country that this is okay. They lay the groundwork with their language, and then they pass the legislation. So the question is, do you forgive Trent Lott? Was this a singular comment, a single comment he made? Well, we know he said almost the same thing 20 years ago, but what really matters is the record. And if you go to the FAIR website, they go through that record. And I think that's very instructive, because this is a man, Trent Lott, who was voted by his party to be Senate Majority Leader for how many years, and now he's the incoming one. Here is a person who, as member of the House of Representatives in 1978, was behind a successful effort to reinstate the citizenship of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. In 1981, the year he became House Minority Whip, Lott prodded the Reagan administration into taking the side of Bob Jones University and other segregated private schools that were suing the IRS to restore tax exemptions withdrawn a decade earlier because of the school's discriminatory racial policies. In 1982 and 1990, Lott voted against extending the Voting Rights Act, the law passed to ensure that minorities, especially Southern blacks, had access to the voting booth. In 1990, he voted against continuation of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the crown jewel of civil rights legislation that desegregated education and public accommodations. In 1983, Lott voted against a national holiday for Martin Luther King Jr., and in 1994, he voted to defund the MLK Jr. Holiday Commission. Lott's appointment to chair the 1984 Republican Platform Committee occasioned a soft New York Times article describing Lott as a legislator who displays political shrewdness while avoiding making waves. That was the same year Lott boasted in a speech to the Sons of Confederate Veterans, quote, "The spirit of Jefferson Davis lives in the 1984 Republican platform." A few months later, in an interview with the neo-Confederate magazine Southern Partisan, Lott, himself a member and promoter of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, repeated Jefferson Davis's posthumous endorsement of the Republican platform, throwing in a reference to the Civil War as the War of Northern Aggression. No one asked Lott then if the original party of Lincoln was becoming the party of Lincoln's chief nemesis. It wasn't until 98 that national press scrutiny focused on one neo-Confederate group, the Council of Conservative Citizens, the CCC. The CCC is the successor to the notorious White Citizens Councils, whose history dates back half a century to the 1950s, when the groups were referred to as the Uptown Klan. Today's CCC rails against race mixing and immigrants and proudly associates with extreme rightists like white supremacist David Dukes. In 1998, Lott denied any personal knowledge of the CCC, falsely claimed through a spokesperson that his links to the group amounted to a single speech a decade before he'd entered the Senate. But in 1992, Senator Lott praised the CCC, the Council of Conservative Citizens, as keynote speaker at its national convention. In 1997, he met with top CCC leaders in his Senate office. His column appeared throughout the 90s in the group's newsletter, which once published a cheerful photo of Lott and CCC members who were also his close relatives. Lott was also the guest of honor at a 1982 banquet hosted by a Mississippi chapter of the Old White Citizens' Councils. The newsletter that his articles are published in talks about blacks as animals, etc. He has a long history, so when you hear this weekend, and you will quite often, the quotes from his 5:30 press conference today asking for forgiveness, that he is opposed to segregation, as deeply believes in the equality of all people, you should think about this. Or maybe think about Bob Herbert's column. Maybe some of you saw it in the New York Times on the op-ed page called Racism and the GOP. And think about whether we should single out Trent Lott. You know, George Bush came out and rebuked him. You might have seen that yesterday, heard that. They have a personal antagonism between them. If you're wondering why this might happen, rebuked him, though he accepted his apology. Does Trent Lott only represent his own point of view? Well, no, says Bob Herbert. Much of the current success of the Republican Party was built on the deliberate exploitation of very similar sentiments. One of the things I remember, Bob Herbert writes, about Reagan's 1980 presidential run was that his first major appearance in the general election campaign was in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which just happened to be the place where three civil rights workers, Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, and James Cheney, were murdered in 1964. During that appearance, Mr. Reagan told his audience, "I believe in states' rights." Enough said. Whenever I think about that appearance, I can't help thinking, he said, about my friend Carolyn Goodman, who after all these years still grieves for the loss of her son, Andrew. One of the controversies that arose during the Reagan presidency concerned Bob Jones University, a religious school in Greenville, South Carolina, that opposed so-called mingling of the races. Interracial dating and marriage were forbidden. The GOP bond with Bob Jones was an intense one, despite the fact that a former head of the university, Bob Jones Jr., had engaged in an astonishing series of attacks on Catholics in the 1980s. The papacy, he said, is the religion of Antichrist and a satanic system. Still, Republican presidential wannabes and other big-time GOP leaders would stumble over each other year after shameful year to appear at the school. George W. Bush, whose brother Jeb and sister-in-law Columba would have been expelled from Bob Jones for having dared to fall in love and marry, was among the GOP biggies who appeared at the school while its racially discriminatory policies were in effect. There are calls now for the ouster of Trent Lott as the Senate Republican leader. I say let him stay. He's a direct descendant of the Dixiecrats and a first-rate example of what much of his party has become. Keep him in plain sight. His presence is instructive, Bob Herbert writes, as long as we keep in mind that it isn't only him. And so as you hear now, Republicans distancing themselves, as well as Trent Lott himself distancing himself, and you think about how long it took Democrats to condemn what he said. Now, one after another are coming out when it's safe, when the media is speaking. Al Gore did say his comments were racist, and you find who's running for president. They're the first. Al Gore, John Kerry did come out and say this as well. But we really have to look at the state of the two-party system and who is representing all of us. No, Trent Lott has not yet resigned, but the operative word is yet. And what's important here, as is important when we look at what happened with Henry Kissinger and with Cardinal Law, is that why these people are under fire is not because of the so-called leaders, but it's because of the grassroots people and communities directly affected who are not afraid to stand up and lay out these people's record, even if it took decades. Henry Kissinger still operates Kissinger Associates and mingles with the most powerful in the world. And I do recommend you see Trials of Henry Kissinger. It's a very important film about his record. He is yet to be picked up, like Augusta Pinochet was picked up in Britain when he went for a doctor's appointment. But there are forces that are moving in on him. Wherever he goes, he checks with the State Department to see if it's safe for him to leave the country and to see if there's anything for him to know. But he is being questioned or asked to testify in places like France, being requested by a French judge to speak. And they will be caught up with eventually because people care. And the vast majority of people in this country do believe in justice, do believe in a uniform standard of justice, don't believe that immigrants should just be shipped out without any representation, don't believe that innocent civilians in Afghanistan, in Yemen, in Iraq should die because the current resident in the White House wants to distract attention. Think about this. You have President Bush, who just bombed Afghanistan and continues to do that, who recently sent a missile into Yemen, a country we have not declared war on, who now says the U.S. is about to invade Iraq. Let's look for a second just to understand how others might see us at the sniper in the greater Washington area. I'm talking about, well, the alleged ones are now in custody. And think about why and how they terrorized Washington, people living in Maryland and Virginia. It was horrifying. They paralyzed millions of people. And what was so frightening about them and what they did is we never knew who they would strike next. Innocent civilians, people just going about their business, who knew who else they would shoot? Right after Bush gave his speech at the United Nations, there were headlines in the paper when I went over to the newsstand. It said, "Who's next?" And it said, "I am God." I thought, oh my God, these newspapers are actually reporting the truth here. I thought they were talking about Bush. But "I am God" was the little note they had found from one of the snipers. And "Who's next," of course, was as these men were horrifying and terrifying all of us. But think about that. Think about how the rest of the world feels about the United States. Those men had one high-powered rifle, and it killed a number of people. We have the most powerful arsenal on earth, and people around the world do not know where the U.S. government will strike next. Afghanistan, Yemen, we're talking about Iraq now, bombing of Vieques. Where else? It's a kind of global sniper politics that's being practiced. And it is very frightening, not only for people around the world, but for all of us here at home, seeing those people terrorized and knowing also what that could mean for us here at home. That's what engenders hatred. That's what inspires violence in some against us. That is what is destabilizing security around the world. I just want to end where I always end, which is in East Timor and then back here at home, which has to do with this issue of hope. And before I end with this remarkable just moment in history when a new country was born and getting the opportunity to be there this past May 20th, after so many people were terrorized, after hundreds of thousands died, I just wanted to mention one other example, one other victory of how people like you have made a difference. And that is the peace movement in this country getting represented on television and the major media. You may have had a major protest here on October 26th, as there were hundreds around the country in Taos. More than half the town turned out, 3,000 people at Donald Rumsfeld's home in Taos, New Mexico, and put a citizen subpoena on his doorstep. More than half the town. We were Pacifica Radio is broadcasting live from the protest in Washington. I was broadcasting with Verna Avery Brown and others at the right next to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, where hundreds of thousands of people had gathered to protest war. And we were calling people around the country in Vermont and Montpelier in the capital, the first major snowstorm, and more than 1,000 people turned out to say no to war as the Gold Dome became white. And there were 6 other protests in Vermont alone. In Seattle, Washington, tens of thousands of people protested. We called Jim McDermott, who was on the street, the congressman who dared to go to Iraq to bear witness and then come back and say no to war. In San Francisco, there were more than 80,000 people, hundreds of cities in this country and around the world. And how was it covered? Well, the New York Times did a piece the next day, and they said, thousands of protesters marched through Washington streets, chanting and waving banners against possible military action against Iraq. Thousands. That could be 2. That could be 3,000. The rally was one of several held in American and foreign cities. That could be 2 cities. That could be 3. And not just in the United States, around the world, 2 or 3. Fewer people attended than organizers had said they hoped for, even though the sun came out. It was on an inside page, and maybe it was better that way. You don't know whether it's better for them to totally ignore it or to misrepresent it like this. It's just incredible. And NPR that night had a report on All Things Considered. The reporter was outside the White House, and she said the estimate is like 10,000 people, but I think there are less, that there are fewer, she said. And she said the people are not as left as the organizers. In fact, she was talking to someone who's for ratcheting up sanctions against Iraq. I guess she got on the wrong subway stop or got off at the wrong subway stop. Was she at the protest that everyone else was at? Well, very interestingly, by the next day, NPR put a retraction on its website and put on that public apology throughout the week and on the following Saturday, and they were forced to go back on what they had reported and to say it was inaccurate. Washington Post on October 27th had a front page story, more than 100,000 people marched in Washington. Why did they say that? Because they could count better? Maybe it had to do with they have an ombudsman who has been getting a tremendous number of complaints from people saying you're inaccurately representing the peace movement in this country and around the world. In fact, a week or two before, there were 400,000 people who marched in London and Hyde Park, and people like Scott Ritter and the great filmmaker John Pilger and the London mayor Ken Livingstone and many others had spoken. New York Times and Washington Post didn't cover it, but they did cover the week before a protest for fox hunting that had the same number of people, big articles. But the peace movement doesn't get coverage, and people started to complain. NPR also has an ombudsperson, which might explain the apology. The New York Times doesn't, and they have this piece that said, you know, even though it was sunny out, there were 2,000 people only who came out to protest war. So we decided to do a story on their coverage since we had been there. We'd seen it all. Viewers of C-SPAN saw the hundreds of thousands. We asked the Park Police, who don't do estimates anymore, right? After the Million Man March, they said there were fewer than 1 million people, and it turned out there were well more, and they were sued, and it was proved. And so they said they won't give out park estimates anymore. But privately, we asked them, and they said there were more than 150,000 people at the protests that day. So we decided to dissect the New York Times piece. Our producer, Mike Burke, read it and said, you know, there are people who are interviewed here. He said, just from the looks of this, I don't think the reporter was at the protest. I said, what do you mean? They're all interviewed. He said, I think this happened before. So we called we found the people who were interviewed and asked them to be on our show and asked them, were you interviewed at the protest? And each one said no. It was 2 days before. And the one woman said she was questioned at the protest by the New York Times reporter on her cell phone. And the New York Times reporter, she said to her, why aren't you here? And the reporter said, well, I was taken off this story and I was put on the sniper story. So she was back at the office. Funny, someone at the protest was handing out the New York Times number to say, tell them to come cover the event. But she said, I'm back at the office. Because you see, you understand how that works in New York Times. They have one reporter, and they have to cover everything. And so they just didn't have the resources for someone to cover one of the largest protests against war in recent history. Anyway, we had all the time. We asked the Times to come on. Of course, we just kept getting hung up on, and the reporter didn't respond to our calls until after we did the piece. And of course, in the end, we realized she was probably being made the fall guy for this because of what happened. As we go to do this piece that day, 3 days later, I opened the paper just before we went on the air, and there was a major piece on the war protest. And it said, I'm talking about the one on October 26th, the same one. This was Wednesday, October 30th. Rally in Washington is said to invigorate anti-war movement, emboldened by a weekend anti-war protest in Washington that organizers called the biggest since the days of the Vietnam War. Groups opposed to military action in Iraq said they are preparing a wave of new demonstrations across the country. The demonstration on Saturday in Washington drew 100,000 people by police estimates and 200,000 by organizers, forming a two-mile wall of marchers around the White House. The turnout startled even the organizers, who had taken out permits for 20,000 marchers. They expected 30 buses and were surprised by 650 buses coming from as far away as Nebraska and Florida. So who do you believe, the New York Times or the New York Times? We called the New York Times editor and we asked for his comment. Why wasn't there a correction in the correction section? These clearly were two contradictory articles. And he said, no, they weren't. I said, okay. Let's see. The first one said the organizers were disappointed, said they fewer people attended than the organizers had said they hoped for, even though the sun came out. That was the first one. And the second one was the organizers were startled by the turnout. They had only taken out a permit for 20,000. They had expected 30 buses and got 650. We said, that is a correction. He said, no, it's a difference of emphasis. But what matters is, it's not that the New York Times went back and counted the numbers of people who were at the protest. It's that they got hundreds of calls by people who either participated or saw it and just said no. You're going to stop misrepresenting this movement, because it makes a difference when we hear an echo. Of people around the country, that echo becomes a bellow, demand is shouted and heard around the world. And also people in other countries then understand that this country is not a monolith, that we do not simply represent a missile or a Black Hawk helicopter, that there are people here, that the majority of people, and I do believe that. I don't think we're talking about a fringe minority. I don't think we're talking about the silent majority. I think we're talking about the silenced majority, silenced by the mainstream media. So that is another story of hope, and it just means we have a lot of responsibilities. It's to make your voices heard and then to make sure that the mainstream media reflects those voices accurately. Timor is just a remarkable story of terrible pain, 200,000 people killed over the last quarter of a century. You can't believe that this population could have survived. But they not only survived under the occupation of Indonesia, the fourth largest country in the world, which was armed to the teeth by the U.S. government, but they have now become a nation of survivors. On May 20th, 2002, I went to East Timor with Alan Nairn, journalist who's been exposing what's happened in East Timor, survived the 1999 razing of East Timor to the ground by the Indonesian military, was arrested and threatened with 10 years in prison, who's covered Guatemala and El Salvador and exposed the U.S. training of Guatemalan and Salvadoran troops and the setting up of the death squads in Latin America. We went back for a remarkable victory celebration of the people of East Timor, even though a third of the population was missing. The people went to Tasitolo, right outside Dili, East Timor, and they watched as Kofi Annan, at 11:45 on May 19th in the night, 100,000 people, Timorese, in their traditional Timorese garb, dancing, singing, celebrating, in an area of Timor that we only knew as a place where bodies were buried. And Kofi Annan came to the stage, and they brought down the United Nations flag. Xanana Gusmão, the rebel leader of East Timor, and now the founding president of East Timor, mounted the lectern and gave his speech in four languages as the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor was raised and fireworks were set off. And you saw in the light of the fireworks the tears of the people, all of them crying. I asked one man who had been tortured and caught many times, many he knew no longer here, a young man who is now an AP reporter in East Timor, stringing for Associated Press, who recently interviewed on another issue an Indonesian general who had personally tortured him. The stories are just amazing. He sat there and watched, and I said, "How do you feel?" He said, "I feel great joy and great pain. I feel we have gained so much and we have lost so many. It's a tremendous victory, but an unbelievably high cost. And the people paid that price, and they never stopped fighting for, marching for, even as they were gunned down by the Indonesian soldiers." Many of you know that in 1991, Pacifica Radio was in East Timor when the Indonesian military marched up on this procession of thousands of Timorese who were honoring another young man who was killed. Again, all of this set off in 1975 when Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford went to Indonesia and gave the go-ahead for an invasion that 90% of the weapons used were from the United States, with thousands of Indonesian military landing by land, by air, and by sea, and just killing the Timorese, closing the country. Thousands became 10,000s, became hundreds of thousands of those killed. But on this night, the people remembered everything and also hoped for everything. But reflecting back to 1991, 10 years ago, when Alan Nairn and I were there watching as the Timorese, in the face of tremendous military might supported by the number one superpower on earth, the United States, watched as the Indonesian soldiers marched up on this procession of thousands, girls in their Catholic school uniforms, men in their boys in their Catholic school uniforms, as they marched to the cemetery to speak out for independence, to speak out for the life of the people of East Timor. And the Indonesian military came up on them. We walked to the front of the crowd knowing that as Westerners, perhaps we could head off an attack on these people because they would be afraid to do it in front of Western reporters. But the Indonesian soldiers with their USM-16s gunned down all the people before our eyes. They just opened fire on thousands of people trapped in the road between two cemeteries that had high walls. Gunning people down from right to left, the first to go down, a little boy, 7 or 8 years old, behind us, who had his hands up in the peace sign. They beat us to the ground. Alan threw his body on top of me to protect me from further injury, and the soldiers put their USM-16s to our heads. They fractured Alan's skull. They beat him until he couldn't protect himself anymore, and then lined up to kill us, as they had killed all the Western journalists when Indonesia first invaded Timor. The only thing we could say after they had stripped us of everything was, "We're from America, America." And even though they had lined up in firing squad fashion and had the guns at our heads and were screaming at us, politique, because we were witnessing what was happening and they considered that political. They eventually took the guns from our heads because they understood we were from the same country that their weapons were from, that they would have to pay a price for killing us that they had never paid for killing the Timorese. And so they pulled the guns from our heads. And when we got out of there that day, got into a Red Cross Jeep that was stopped by many Timorese who jumped on top of us and on top of the Jeep and hung off of the spare tire in the back, and in that way we drove as a human mass to the hospital. At the hospital, the doctors and nurses who were there operating on the Timorese, they had killed more than 250 Timorese on that one day. When they looked at us, they started to cry, the doctors and nurses. Alan was covered in blood, his skull was fractured, but we weren't in worse shape than the Timorese. They started to cry because I think we as Americans represent two things to the rest of the world. We represent the sword and we represent the shield. The sword because the U.S. has provided the weapons that have killed so many people all over the world, whether it's the Indonesian military in Timor, 200,000, or whether it's the training and the military weapons in Guatemala and in El Salvador through the 80s, whether it's in Nigeria or in Colombia right now, what have we provided more than $1 billion as the human rights abusing military there protects the oil pipelines of British Petroleum and Occidental. We represent two things: the sword, all of those weapons pointed at innocent civilians around the world, but also, as American citizens, we represent the shield. And people around the world know, ultimately, it is up to us here at home in the most powerful nation on earth to turn those weapons from their heads. They are our weapons. This killing is done in our name. I think about Phil Berrigan today, and I think about a quote, I don't know who said it, but it is, I look back on my life and I think about all the times I thought I went too far, and I realize now that I didn't go far enough. Phil Berrigan would never have that regret, or we don't think he should. He probably would, wanted to die in jail, but I think back on my life, at all the times that I thought I went too far, and realize now that I didn't go far enough. Think about that quote. Think about that in your own lives. As the most powerful country on earth, your country now, decides whether or not, in your name, it will set its sights on the children of Iraq. More than 1 million of them have already died over the last 10 years. And now the question is, what will happen to the rest of them? It's up to you. What do you want to represent, the sword or the shield? Thank you.